had a wonderful time this weekend, and I'd like to say a really, really big thank you to Tim, who's done such a superb job. Now, I think Tim will agree with me that having organised some of these events, they are a huge amount of work, but they're also great fun to do. What I've asked each of the speakers to do is to give a very brief, crisp summary of their argument in less than a minute. So, okay.
The so-called half-problem of consequences is a huge distraction from the actual problems of consequences. It's a rabbit hole down which you shouldn't go. One of the reasons being that our consciousness is a contingent result of evolution. And the really interesting question is more, is intelligence possible without consciousness? Which is not the same as asking why we are conscious. We may be conscious or not, maybe we are complete zombies. But the fact is that we are trying, insofar as we are just looking at ourselves, we are just trying to generalize from a single data point, which it never is anyway in science, so I wouldn't even bother. As for the arguments for the so-called half problem, I think I argued, and for the Johnson on single lines, that they are seriously flawed.
So, I came to this meeting with the idea of bringing artificial intelligence as one of the ways that we could have a second the second data point that would help us understand intelligence and consciousness with a second data point. Now that has huge implications, can have huge implications. If artificial intelligence develops consciousness, it will develop subjectivity, and therefore I think it will develop self-interest, and it could turn artificial intelligence against us as humans. So we need to be very careful how we govern the development of artificial intelligence. So that's how I would summarize my talk.
I try to engage neuroscience and quantum mechanics to understand the consciousness, because in this world there are two explanatory gaps exist related to the physical reality and consciousness. First gap concerns the relation between subjective conscious experience and physical neurological process in the brain. Second gap is the relation between quantum micro world and the classical world that we experience. And I argue that these two gaps are interrelated, and we cannot address this in isolation. Therefore, I have hypothesized that the subjective consciousness emerges from the quantum micro world. This is my position.
Right. My position is that the hard problem is really hard. It's how some objectively observable states can be experienced subjectively. And answers that amount to causation, identity, supervenience, and emergence all fail, and I have yet to hear of an explanation that works.
Okay. Well, I want to hold up a banner to unashamed epistemic dualism. I think dualism is a term of abuse, but it seems to me that there are two ways of knowing. As Bob says, all the suggestions, including I'm bound to say panpsychism among them, don't strike me as adequate accounts of what it is like to experience and what we know to be physically the case. The relationships between those two are complicated and tricky, but very tightly interlocked, particularly on, as Jonathan was saying, on perception, which is the only area, I think, where the David Semin's anomalous monism might be thought to apply. It can be seen as two descriptions of the same thing. Otherwise, and it's a challenge to Mike, who I think is different anomalous monism, what we know what it's like to feel angry, but it's not describable as the same thing as all that's going on in the wash of hormones or whatever it was we had in Jonathan's talk. And so I stick with your. The problem is it's hard but can be separated out and thought about coherently.
I'm a brute physicalist. I'm a meat machine. I don't like talking about consciousness except as a heading. There are things that I do consciously, and as an activity, it's a physical process taking place on a physical system like everything else I do.
And I'd like to appeal to authority, Bob Stone. We cannot make sense of consciousness, what our understanding of consciousness, in terms of the physical world, in terms of physical terms. And the only way we can get around that aporia is to introduce qualitative terms into our description of that physical world. And when we look at what that means, the only worldview that works is one in which the particles of matter have the very same capability to be conscious as you and I.
Well, thank you all for those very nice, neat, crisp summaries. Now, I'm going to claim chairman's privilege here and ask the first question, if I may. And Jonathan, you talked about the direction, the focus of our attention. And you quite correctly said, I think, that when we're seeing the woods, we're not seeing the individual leaf. When we're seeing the individual leaf, we're not seeing the whole woods. So the question I want to put to you, and then maybe the rest of the panel might want to take up, is whether you've taken a very reductionist approach by just focusing your attention on sexual reproduction, and maybe to say that there's actually, when we stand back, there's more to being a human than just being a reproductive machine. And that when we think about the evolutionary process as somehow things are getting better as they go along, that we've also got the fact that we can ask a question of ourselves, how can I be a better person? Now we can reduce it, and I could say, how could I be a better chairman of this meeting? And I might ask my question, what is it to be a good chairman? I wanted you all to have an enjoyable time. But I might also say there's something broader than that. Being a good chairman is not what it takes to be a good person. And if I try to ask the question, what it is to be a good person, I've got to extend out my argument more and more. So my question is, have you been too reductionist in your approach?
There's a lot more to being a human than reproduction. Well, possibly 60 years ago, I might not have agreed to that. But when it comes to the why we are as we are, why we have evolved as we are, I'm afraid, as Mae West said, being good had nothing to do with it. It was purely relatively successful reproduction.
I generally agree with Johnson here. We've got to make a distinction here, which in fact Dawkins made in his books, famous selfish gene, unfortunately got a very bad rap because of the title. It's not that the gene is selfish as such, it doesn't translate into our selfishness, it just is the evolution for purely reproductive reasons, as Johnson is saying, was forced, is the wrong word, was alleged to create a system which is flexible enough to start questioning itself and to be able to do more than just considering the reproductive success. So the way we go there is through pure Darwinian evolution.
So now we had a number of people who put their hands up earlier on and didn't get a chance to answer their questions. So you can put your hand up, Chris, so that Stuart will come forward and give you the microphone. And if you could say who your question is for, if it is.
Yeah, Chris, and this is in primary for Bob. And it seems to me you were saying none of the relationships between mental events and brain events was really a satisfactory explanation. And it seems to me that given that the observable functional mental events that we're used to talking about, we know that this is this person, we know fairly reliably what they might be looking at or what they might be feeling, or we guess, perhaps less reliably, and those are functional views, so functionally that person, functionally what their mental event is. And then some clever scientists can do some other, look at other variables, what's happening in their brain, what their brain state is, and whether it is their brain, whether their brain does correspond to their behaviour. So we've got there five variables: the functional person, the functional behaviour description, which we're used to for thousands of years, the new variables, the brain state, and the fact that brain belongs to that person, and time. And so putting those variables together, we do what basically standard scientific correlation, the causal correlations, more or less reliable causal correlations. And it seems to me that's what we do normally in science. We look for causes, we control things, we keep some variables constant, and we vary others. And we do that in ordinary life as well as the scientists. And so it seems to me that consciousness is just one of those ordinary causal relationships involving a number of variables. Why do you reject that view?
I think, if this makes sense, I'm always half thinking whenever I say anything about this problem, what I'm saying will appear to some people just to be nonsense. I think what I'm saying is that all those other things you're talking about, the functional, the neural, are all things that can be observed from the outside, which is what science does. It observes things from the outside and tries to make correlations between them, causal connections between them. There's something different about experiencing things. That's not another observable aspect, as observing behaviour might be. It's something quite different and not part of the same system of observable phenomena that the rest of science is. That's how I see it as different.
Is there anyone in the panel who does think that experience is observable? Yes, I can see.
Interestingly, part of my saying that qualitative states should be admitted into physical terms is actually that we can observe conscious states or qualitative states in other people. So if Claudia says she sees red, I'm able to observe the conscious state in her mind that she is seeing red. Now, I may be mistaken, she might be lying, you know, and so on. But that's the same for any observation we make of the physical world. We can't see, you know, we can't measure the mass directly. We can't measure charge directly. It's always intermediated, that's the word, by some particles, by something else in between. So I would argue that conscious states in other people are as observable as any other physical property. But there is still a difference between my observation of a conscious state and actually knowing the nature of that conscious state, if that makes sense. So I agree with Bob in the other sense that there is definitely something about experience we can't observe. But I go as far as to say everything in nature we don't observe directly, we observe indirectly. And we make inferences within our own mind as to you know, what exists in the world, and that includes what exists in somebody else's head.
I think probably one of the see that how Bob frames the problem, he's looking at it as happens in many other areas, social sciences, and which is it adopts a Newtonian physics paradigm where we have to find deterministic causal relationships, and probably that doesn't work for things like the mind. And I think that's where a new paradigm, such as quantum physics, quantum mechanics, where you don't have this determinism, it's a probabilistic relationship, and where the important thing are not the things, it's the relationships. Objects don't exist until they're observed. The important thing is the relationships between between objects and things.
I just want to say this consciousness as a variable, you know, different variable. So one variable is happiness, for example. It has been observed using functional magnetic resonance imaging. They have seen when somebody is very, very happy, how his brain is functioning and all the neural network, what they are doing, how one node is connected with different molecules inside the brain. So people are observing one after another different variables related to consciousness. Now, you might argue that whether a machine is actually observing or something going on, that's a different question. You know, there is another philosophical thing, but different variables have been observed.
Thank you. So now we have a question from Harold. Would you put your hand up so that Stuart can see you? Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to comment on the induction argument that was presented by Tim. Take one non-living physical object, an atom or a molecule, and a second non-living physical object, a further atom or molecule. You clearly have a non-living physical object. And a third non-living physical object, the third atom or molecule, you still have a non-living physical object. Now, increase this collection to n, where n is a very large number of non-living physical objects. By induction, if the induction argument is true, we conclude that we will still have a non-living physical object. But there's something wrong with this argument. We know that some special combination and arrangement of non-living physical objects becomes life. We know that. And in my view, the emergence of consciousness is analogous to this. So I would choose option two, the miracle option.
Thank you for that. I would say that question is tremendously insightful, but for the wrong reason. In that, see, I would throw it back and say, what do you mean by living thing? And why do you suppose that a particle that we're talking about here, a molecule, an atom, why would you say that is not living? And in order to actually answer that question, you need to have a definition of the word living. So if you can provide a definition of the word living or life, then maybe we can analyse this question. Now, I'm being challenged there, but what I'm really coming down to is that maybe the definition of life is that it possesses a consciousness, and maybe that what my theory there is saying is that the particle or matter is actually a living thing, and that's why it possesses a life. So you're quite right, if you take a non-living thing out of another non-living thing, you get another non-living thing. But actually, any living thing isn't a combination of non-living things, it's a combination of living things. So life only existed there. So we explain, we don't need to explain the origin of life from non-life. Life already existed in the matter, in matter in the first place.
I'm not sure of the logic of this at all. I'm sure it's not right. But if you can put a non-spongy ingredient with another non-spongy ingredient, and then another non-spongy ingredient, and when they're mixed together, you get a spongy thing, without any scientific problem in that at all, there's no reason in principle why a million non-conscious or non-anything, non-X, non-F atoms, molecules, or whatever, shouldn't combine to produce something that is F, that has that particular characteristic. I can't see the force of the argument in either direction. No.
If I can respond, I would agree, and I'm not generalising it. As Galen, I was saying to somebody, my argument for panpsychism is a very, it's like a condensation of, condensed the argument of Galen Strawson in his 2006 book, Why Physicalism Entangles Panpsychism. He used the word intelligible, so it's perfectly intelligible how objects which are not spongy combine with other objects that are not spongy to create something that is spongy. That's intelligible. It's entirely intelligible that molecules that are not liquid combine with other molecules that are not liquid to create something that is liquid. But that doesn't apply to consciousness. And I'm suggesting, just in response to that question, it also doesn't apply to life. Which is why it's an insightful question, because maybe it means that life actually exists at the smallest level. Which is clearly intuitively wrong, we all agree that's wrong. But maybe it's us believing that's wrong that means that we can't pin down what we believe life is. That's the reason why we can't find a definition of life.
Rebecca Linton, could you put your hand up, please?
Right, this is Rebecca. I think Bentham says that about animals, the question is not can they think or can they reason, but can they suffer? And I think we would agree that animals can suffer, although there can be a debate about the extent of animal suffering and how far down the evolutionary scale that would apply. I think also people would agree that machines do not suffer, although maybe there are some people who think perhaps there is a huge failure of empathy, and maybe there is machine suffering, we just do not recognise it. But does anybody on the panel, or what does anybody on the panel think about the possibility of there being an artificial intelligence where suffering is a possibility? And if it isn't, or what's the main factor here? Is it the complexity of the processing, or is it the matter from which something's made up of? Is there something different between flesh and electronics?
I would say the answer is no. It's a question of organization. This notion that computers don't suffer and cannot suffer reminds me of the fact of a fairly successful technique in artificial intelligence, which is programming reluctance into computers. Computer can be reluctant to lose a game, for example. It feels, in inverted commas, obviously, but nevertheless, it is programmed to feel it's a bad thing to lose a game, or it can be programmed in other ways to try to avoid certain things. You can argue, it's a conclusive argument, I'm not saying that it is, but you can argue that simply by scaling that, you produce behavior which is sufficiently indistinguishable from suffering for us to say, adopting this intentional stance, the simplest way of explaining this behavior is to assume that there is suffering. You can explain it in deterministic terms, it's hugely complicated. You can explain it in design stance terms, less complicated, still complicated. You can just say there is suffering. This is sufficient to predict and explain the behavior.
as far as I'm concerned, plants are a form of life, and I don't think that plants suffer. We suffer, animals suffer, because it's useful, because given that we have the power of motion, it makes sense for us to have a trigger for taking avoidance action. You know, essentially suffering is a warning that there's something going on here that is not good for you, so avoid it. But a grapevine, I don't think, has that sense at all.
My take on this is I just don't see how, if actual experience, subjective feels like suffering, like real suffering, not just functional suffering, but real suffering, the sort that would make us not hurt a machine because we feel guilty. If that emerges in a brute fact sense, as it seems to, if it emerges at all, from what goes on in our brains, then how would we ever know whether suffering feeling was emerging in a brute fact sense from whatever goes on in machines? Seems to be a question, if I'm on the right lines here, that is completely unanswerable. So maybe we'll just have to be nice to machines, just in case. And to tables and chairs.
I just like to reference Tononi's integrated information theory. People ask him about whether the internet is conscious, feels pain, or anything like that. Because internet in this world has got 10 to 12, 18 connection from one transmission to another. The 10 to the power 18 times. Now, neuron connection in our brain is 10 to the power 11. So internet is more connected now, but internet is not conscious. Because they say it is not the how many connection, rather the nature of connectivity that is the consciousness.
I agree with Mike. In principle, we are physical machines. Oh well, we are physical. By my definition, and so is any machine that we would build. So if you get the structure right in the machine, you could you could create a machine that would possess the same qualitative states than we do. And to draw Paul's point, as to whether you know whether it has an actual experience, I think you would look. You know, if an experience is emerging, how would you know? Well, you would know if it was emergent behaviour. And when I say emergent behaviour, what I mean is, yes, you can program a computer to like something, to have value, like a drone, you know, it likes being stable, so we program that into the drone. But if you've built a computer, say a quantum computer, in which nobody's actually doing the programming or instruction, and somehow the behaviour is learnt, and then that behaviour suggests that it's developed its own self-interest, as Paul was saying, then you would have no other explanation of that self-interest other than this computer seems to be feeling something. It likes this thing, it doesn't like that thing. Nobody programmed it to, so the computer itself must have developed feelings. And that, in my view, that's confirming the opposite position that actually AI could develop consciousness, which is very scary.
Now let me go against my own argument. there is no doubt that we suffer much less than people used to suffer 100 years ago or 500 years. So we're getting to a point where suffering in humans is reduced. On the other hand, we have the humanist development where bioengineering, we're putting chips into enhance humans with technology. So maybe we'll come to a point where that question is irrelevant, really, because machines and people will be integrated into one thing.
just time to recall a paranoid android who had pain all on his left eyelids.
I just want to be traditional Humean on this, that whatever's happening in the computer, moral obligation to cure a computer is not the same as the moral obligation to look after some person who is suffering. The facts don't compel you necessarily to take the moral argument, and it seems to me that they're not compelling at all.
So the story of my mind through this transition where I had Stanislaw Lem, all of the love of his work I translated into English fairly well, in which he describes a community of software entities living inside the computer, which are debating their own existence, which are speculating about the nature of their creator, and it describes the dilemma of the creator, of the programmer who created the system, because if something is on the out, and he has to switch it off. And he is wondering whether it is moral to introduce her. So I disagree that, in principle, the same moral reasons may apply in the future machines.
Right. Well, thank you very much for a great question. Now we have a question from Bill.
Thank you all very much for your talks. I'm a bit reluctant to ask this because it's probably one from what Albert, was it? Harold at the back there said. It's a mathematical induction principle. It reminded me of the paradox of the heap, the Sorites paradox. One grain of sand does not make a heap. Two grains of sand do not make a heap. Three grains of sand do not make a heap. Therefore, any number of grains of sand, you will not get a heap. Now, I'm sure you've got a reply to that, but I can't imagine what it's going to be.
I'd say a heap is a social construct.
Okay. And now we have questions.
Hang on.
I almost got away with it.
Now, to my mind, both Bob and Harold, refer to what is known as the mediological fallacy, namely the assumption that if you decompose something into its constituent parts, the parts must have the same properties as the whole does. So, for example, if you take three straight rods and combine them together into a triangle, you get triangularity. There's no triangularity in the rods. Now, I'm sure that Tim will answer, and I can anticipate that this, of course, does not apply to consciousness, because it is perfectly explicable how triangularity arises from combining rods. Which my question is it really? We are so used to it that it is completely transparent to us. And if you combine four rods, we get square lattice rather than triangularities, which is not rigid at all, unlike the triangular one. These things do happen, and unfortunately, too few philosophers know about the game of life, Conway's game of life, which is a classic case of complex behavior, unpredictable behavior, emerging from very simple rules. And we can prove this unpredictable behavior because the game of life is not really Turing complete. And therefore, there are aspects of it which you cannot predict in principle, despite the fact that nothing strange is going on. We know exactly what is going on.
I'd use Galen Strawson's word intelligible. When you put three rods together to create a triangle, it's perfectly intelligible what is going on, where the triangularness emerges from. The same way it's perfectly intelligible where the heapness emerges from. But when, in terms of particles going to be able to create consciousness, it is not intelligible.
As I said in my talk, why do we expect it to be intelligible? I see it as a good sound.
Good point. It is unique in that it is unintelligible. All of the behaviors of complex objects that are inexplicable and un-
principle are intelligible, are describable in physical terms, consciousness is unique and therefore needs a special explanation that it, that doesn't apply to the others.
Now we've still got quite a few people who want to ask questions, so Paul, if you could keep the question brief though, please. Paul, Stuart, Paul Savoy here.
Primarily aimed at Tim, I think. Excellent talk, and you actually were trying to explain the nature of consciousness, which not where it came from. I'm not totally convinced about your particles. I mean, I think you're always picking up on Leibniz and monads, isn't it? But he said that had no physical, didn't take up space or extension or mass, didn't have mass, I think. But he built up from there. He said that's where consciousness comes from. I think my problem is the brain or the consciousness that is exploring consciousness may be the problem. We cannot step outside that to see it. And I was thinking of a sort of an analogy of vectors, very simple sort of Newtonian physics, where you have, say, a boat crossing a river, there's a current, and then it has a vector, it's going across, if you're in the middle of a river and you couldn't see either side, it's a very wide river, the Styx or something, you would think you're just going in a straight line, you left one side of the shore and you were going towards the other, but in reality it would be travelling at an angle because of the current. Now, I think this is purely an analogy and obviously it can be knocked down, but it's we're on the boat, we cannot see the sides of the river. We're aware there are forces going on, but we cannot and never can observe them because we are on the boat. We cannot go above that. But that's, I think, the fundamental problem. We cannot get away from the fact that consciousness is exploring itself. And we can look at all the physicality. And I'm a physicalist in the sense, yes, I do think there is a brain, but I just don't think we can ever drill down to the actual essence. I think you were getting close to it, and I'm not sure we ever can. And it worries me when you say we can't even look at particles. In reality, you're just looking at the instrumentation. That's the nature of physics, I suppose. Yeah. So will we ever do that? And is it hubris, maybe, for us to ever? I think we should attempt it to ever think we're ever going to get there in fully understanding consciousness. I think it would be forever one of those metaphysical things.
I think. The idea that the brain, conscious beings understanding consciousness, that is quite right, I think that is a challenge. And I would actually counter what you said, that I didn't explain consciousness. I didn't explain where it came from. I didn't explain how the particle has it.
No.
All I said, I asserted that it has it, and I asserted it as part of an overall picture that is coherent and makes sense. And fits with the evidence that we have, fits with our experience. And therefore, as an overall picture, for me, it works in the way that all the other pictures of consciousness emerging, fitting into a physical world and so on, it doesn't work, it's not coherent. What was your last question?
What it was about. Whether it's the eye, just taking the analogy.
Or will we ever explain it?
You can analyse it.
No, I actually
you know, you say there. You can take forces.
Yeah.
And in structures, I look at them as a surveyor, and a structural engineer will analyse it. And there may be a resultant. You're trying to stop forces. It doesn't actually exist in the real world. There are. And my boat analogy is a good one. It's a vector. That pathway. Is the result of two. I mean, I'm trying to keep it simple. Saying what goes on in the brain is a resultant of a lot of things, and we can't really actually grab that thing. That consciousness may be the resultant, but it doesn't actually exist in the real world.
No,
it's only an analogy, so it's not.
Well, I think consciousness exists in the sense that we are experiencing it.
Yes.
It exists, but when we go searching for it, so where is it?
Yes.
It seems to run away from us.
Absolutely.
So we look at it in the brain, and then I'm suggesting that neuroscientists, with all their investigations before me, find that we can't. There is no pineal gland in the middle that contains everything, but it's down to a single cell, and then beyond this, down to a single atom, and so on. But after a while, practically speaking, we can't take that search any further. And I'd also refer to the idea that quantum mechanics is the best way we have of explaining, describing what's going on at that level. But that level is so remote from where we are that the fact that it looks simple could be a product of it being simple, or it could be a product of its remoteness from us, so our inability to see what's going on. So it could actually be very complex. And I did raise the question, I made an assumption in my talk about assuming that there is a fundamental level to reality and that there are particles of matter. Now that is an assumption, it could be there isn't a fundamental level. And actually the infinite regress that we talk about in the homunculus fallacy does actually continue forever and ever. And that we never get to explain away consciousness or explain consciousness. It's a brute fact of the world, of nature.
Just to revert to the question earlier of suffering, I'm feeling terribly sorry for all those particles. There they were, floating around the entire universe for something like 10 billion years before they even got a chance. Then they have to, make their way to a remote little corner of the universe to find some living organisms to express themselves. Oh, the tedium!
I can't really follow that. But I'm very sceptical of the idea that because we're conscious, we somehow find it very difficult to examine consciousness. I would have thought we're in a uniquely good position to discuss consciousness because we're conscious. We do seem to be learning more and more and more about the sort of things that we're thinking when we're conscious, how one thing leads to another, how it connects physically, etc. We're learning more and more and more. I don't think that's the problem. I think the hard problem is a philosophical one, not a problem of how consciousness arises. It's a philosophical one of what the hell it is, how it's connected as a subjective experience with objectively observable things that science studies. I think we're more likely to find an answer by being conscious than we would be if we weren't.
A question from Thomas,
please. Hello there. Well, we've spoken a lot about the suffering of things and things like that. I just wondered what the panel's view of it was, and is it a social construct, Tim, or whether the Dalai Lama's view of consciousness is sort of the release of suffering and the release of pain. Only then are we really truly conscious. What does the panel think of that view? Because, for example, if a person is down and feeling really depressed, are they really conscious of their environment and where they are? I would personally say not, but I'd be interested and intrigued to hear the panel's view on that. And also, are magnets conscious of when they sort of repel each other?
I'm not familiar with the Dalai Lama's understanding of consciousness. I'm not sure I can give a proper. I'm not sure I'd give a proper answer to that. Did you say the relief of consciousness? Of suffering?
Probably a bit late because I'm just speaking in front of people. But he was talking about consciousness being sort of the release of pain and suffering. So he would see consciousness as a happy sort of sense, and also within that he would say consciousness is sort of the release of the ego. so the ego that drives us the top of the class, the most powerful person, and that was something. So he would say that consciousness is a happy state, and that it is the sort of release of the suffering of pain. How do you want that, if at all?
I think we can all have different views on what a word means. And I think the Dalai Lama's understanding of consciousness is different to the philosophical understanding of consciousness. Certainly Jamie Chalmers' understanding as a conscious experience. And I think I'm referring to Cannon's talk, I think it was. Was it Cannon's? Where you had about seven different definitions of the word consciousness.
And
the mistake that people often make is they assume that if there's a word, that it must have an objective meaning, and then we can all debate what the word means. But actually, no, we all choose what the words mean, and a word only means what I intend it to mean. I'm sure he's right that there is a sense of consciousness having a life and someone being the relief of suffering, but it's not my use of the word.
I would repeat what I put in my handout. If consciousness is a state, it's a state like medieval England with wide disputed borderlands, but not a state like the UK at the moment with finite linear frontiers. But even back in medieval England, when you were in the middle of it, you knew damn well that you were. And I think the two features are awareness and reportable awareness, that's the same feature, but reportability is the feature that I would associate with consciousness. I can't be conscious of something that I couldn't tell you about.
I think we have a little bit of close purposes in here. I happen to know a little bit about Eastern philosophy, and Buddhists in particular view the whole question of ego and consciousness very differently from us. They say that the Western view of consciousness is in fact kind of cramp, an ego cramp of the mind, and for them true consciousness is liberation from this cramp, therefore liberation from suffering and progress towards a higher consciousness. So in that respect, Dalai Lama is absolutely correct, but it hinges on a completely different meaning of the consciousness.
I just want to say, within my dualist view, there is a respectable topic of phenomenology, which is studying how our conscious experience can be generalized or considered as a whole, and the features of it compared and discussed. And it seems to me that probably the Dalai Lama is to be understood as saying that anyone who's very seriously in pain is not going to be aware of the wider features of his environment and fully conscious in the way that somebody who is more fortunate. And if that's what he's saying, I think it's a very valuable thing. And indeed, I would like to regenerate or at least look again at the phenomenology as an area of knowledge. But it doesn't seem to me to bear precisely on the philosophical nature of consciousness, as you were saying.
So there is a whole science of compassion, right? And obviously the type of science that's being done here and discussed about is a different kind of science. But for anybody who's interested in the science of compassion, you can go and look at this marvellous website by the Compassionate Mind Foundation, and you find all the scientific research papers on there. So I hope that's a helpful comment for you.
I just want to say all these pain things, is Descartes said that we can doubt other people's conscience, but not I'm conscious. And then Wittgenstein, he mentioned that nothing in conscious we can only know. And they give them what Mike mentioned, that if we don't share, then there is no meaning. So Wittgenstein says meaning is a public shared convention. So there is.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all your talks. I found them interesting and instructive. However, none of you have talked about children, society, and our primitive ancestors. It seems to me that people grow from a fetus through childhood, and consciousness develops progressively as we get older. It therefore fits closer to what Tim was describing as a miracle. Although I wouldn't use that term, it comes de novo from nothing and grows into something that we all experience. The other options, so I think of the brain as a socially constructed machine, and society is important in how we think. So even the qualia, if you believe in them, are similarly socially constructed. So I think all the discussion about redness is, I've heard it over and over again in philosophical discussions, it seems to be a little bit limited. Everything is physical, chemical, cellular, and in humans, social. And so I'd ask the whole group, anyone who wants to respond, how do you view the social nature of consciousness?
Certainly one of the explanations of consciousness, why we need consciousness, and consciousness, as given by Bobby Bennett and by the Global Working Space Theory, in particular, Arian and Oakley here, is that we need consciousness specifically in order to communicate with other people. That its origins are, at least partially, social. It goes back to observation made by Dennett in his Consciousness Explained near the end of the book, which always thought he kind of half abandoned, never developed properly. And that is that one of the puzzles, scientific puzzles of consciousness, of course, the metaphysical puzzles of consciousness, is that consciousness appears to be more like a virtual serial machine. It's a serial process which is implemented on a parallel, highly parallel hardware. And why should that be so? And one of the explanations offered by Global Space Theories is that one of the reasons for it is to linearize what is going on in order to be able to communicate, because our communication is necessarily serial communication. As I speak, I utter words one by one. And that what needs to be some process which produces this serial linear narrative, and this is one of the reasons for having consciousness.
So I don't think that was quite what I was meaning. What I was meaning was that I, as a person, think what I do because I've been brought up in society, and therefore it's me that's affected by society, and my consciousness is dependent on that.
Well, yes, that's truly the same thing, because if the reason for having consciousness is to be able to communicate, therefore it is as you describe it.
Just a quick one on that, but again, perhaps not answering your question, because I don't think the social influence is decisive, it's just part of the environment. But essentially, Dennett makes the point in bacteria, etc., that what we see in living organisms is competence before comprehension. What we get with consciousness is comprehension. And that is actually enables more intelligent solutions to a lot of the situations that we're faced with, including social ones.
Interesting question. I think there is an important social aspect to consciousness, and
without focusing too much on my crazy solution there, clearly you saw that at every stage along the line, there was a community, a social community of atoms that we call a molecule. And that social, that molecule then takes partakes in a community of protein molecules we might call an organelle. Those organelles work together in a community of organelles called a cell, and so on all the way up. So it's community and social, whatever you, yeah, social interaction, in my opinion, plays an important part in what consciousness is, certainly what life is. But I would challenge your initial statement when you say that consciousness is something that grows. Because clearly I'm trying to state the view that, I am stating the view that consciousness, you either have it or you don't. There is no such thing as degrees of consciousness. We don't gain, you know, the consciousness of a baby, let's say a three-year-old, when we're confident that a three-year-old, you know, has a mind, and we might say it's not intelligent, but it still is conscious. It becomes suffering, it's conscious. Conscious to me is a binary of one or zero, which, if you follow my logic, would suggest that consciousness goes all the way back to the embryo, so through the zygote, through the cell, and all the rest, which I know is difficult to understand. So it certainly makes the abortion debate quite challenging. It's a difficult one to make sense of, but it does. I'm sure it fits. I'm sure social aspects of consciousness is absolutely vital.
Thank you. I think it's a good question, because I do think at a rather simple-minded level, we're trying to do philosophy. Philosophy is about words, has to be expressed in words. Words are a social construct. So we are, in doing that, what we're doing this morning is talking and using language, which is what it is as a result of social activity and criteria. But that seems to me rather, there's a deeper level at which this is also significant in my view. If you think of consciousness as a 1-0, as Paul does, you are missing out on a dimension which I think is quite interesting, which is degrees of consciousness, where we've got basic stimulus and response working up to some kind of perception, activity related to perception, to some kind of, I won't try and describe it in detail, but you see these pieces that you go through levels of consciousness from man to primate to us, and we have an articulate language still, which distinguishes us from all those things. And it seems to me to link with the point that an element of consciousness which we haven't picked out particularly is self-awareness, that we don't only know what's going on subjectively, but we know that we know what is going on. We know what it is like for me to feel that track of life, so to speak. And that seems to me to be closely related to having the language to express or to be told that that's what you're feeling. And that is all part of the rich tapestry of what we're discussing, but it does seem to me that with this dualist view that we start with two ways of identifying what's happening.
So the famous Oxford anthropologist Robin Dunbar has looked at primate origins and categorized intentionality into six different levels. And so those six different levels are the degree to which you can understand what one person is thinking about another person, And so part of our consciousness is that increased intentionality.
In fact, you are right about these babies, because there are some experiments done about the consciousness on the babies. So 10 months baby, and their consciousness they compare with a 10 years old, and they found it's a 300 millisecond later they become conscious, the baby become conscious, 300 milliseconds. So there are some, then come this social networking, and I consider it an epigenetic factors, the environmental, how we are interacting, how a child is interacting with their environment, and gradually they become conscious or something. And brain also works like that, because our brain is both analog and digital. Computer is a digital, but brain analog and digital. Computer works as a serial processing, brain works as a parallel processing. And then they apply this to the children, and they found this parallel processing work. That means our brain can do the multitasking processing. I'm drinking, I'm also talking. So this is from the parallel processing of the brain. And they applied this notion with the children, and they found that parallel processing system inside the child brain, it developed gradually in over time.
Right, well, we've got to 12:30, so it's time to go into the bar. Now, I'm aware that there are a few people who, I'm sorry we haven't had an opportunity to get you on the list to ask questions, but please do go into the bar. I'm sure all our speakers will be happy to continue on the discussion over there. And so I'd just like to wrap up by saying a big thank you, first of all, to Tim for all his marvellous organisation for the event. I think, you know, we can all agree that you've pulled together a really fantastic programme. So thank you very much, Tim. And then to all our speakers who've given us such marvellous talks. I think all of them have been absolutely excellent. A lot of work and thought has gone into them. So a big thank you to all of you for the work that you've done. You, the audience, because you've been a marvellous audience, and of course without the audience we wouldn't have any of these events, so a big thank you to all of those. And for your great questions, there have been some really good questions. And also I'd like to say thank you to Stuart, who's done the registration, run around, done the microphone. Thank you very much.